busy doing nothing, working the whole day through, trying to find lots of things not to do. We're busy going nowhere, isn't it just a crime? We'd like to be unhappy, but we never do have the time.
Now, my next guest is Pico Iyer, and as he admits, he's been travelling since the age of 9. When he grew up, he decided to combine his love for travel with the need to earn a crust and become a travel writer, and he was extraordinarily successful in this pursuit. For over 20 years, his work's been in the New York Times, the New York Review of Books, Harper's Time. The list goes on, and he's also the author of many works of nonfiction. You might recall we chatted back in 2000. Well, perhaps you don't recall, but I do. After he wrote The Global Soul, Jet Lag, Shopping Malls, and The Search for Home. And with that little Bing Crosby ditty as a preamble, I welcome him back to our little wireless program to talk about his latest, which is a charming little book, beautifully produced, with the title The Art of Stillness, Adventures in Going Nowhere. Welcome back, Pico.
Thank you. It's really nice to talk to you again.
How paradoxical are the adventures of going nowhere for someone who spent their life going everywhere?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think probably the more you travel, the more you need to sit still, if only to hold on to some sanity. So, of course, somebody who's never traveled and who's got too much stillness in her life probably longs to go and see the other continents. But, you know, as that Bing Crosby song suggested, I think more and more of us have this sense of being out of breath and racing to catch up with our lives. And, you know, the more time-saving devices we have, the less time we seem to have. And I think it's all sort of got out of control a bit.
Well, there are people, of course, who have stillness forced upon them. They might be in solitary confinement, or they might be some of my colleagues at the ABC who have just been dismissed pretty much en masse. But let's stick with the central issue, and that is a sort of creative stillness. You're not going new age on me. You're not going to reveal a sudden passion for meditation.
No, no, have no fear. I've never meditated in my life. You know, I admire, I think some people turn to yoga and meditation and Tai Chi and those ancient disciplines to keep themselves centered, but that's never been my particular thing. I suppose I'm probably more interested in the wisdom of the old age. In other words, if you look at the old Greeks and Roman thinkers, or if you look at the poets of China and Japan where I live, most of them were saying the same thing, which is all we need in life is balance, and we have to step back a little from everything that's going around just to begin to understand it. So my form of meditation is just when I'm on the treadmill in the health club, I try these days not to turn on the TV. When I'm on a plane, as I was last night, every now and then it's nice just to not do anything and let my mind drift and see where it will take me. So sort of informal forms of being still.
Now, this therapy has what outcome for you, Pico?
Happiness, actually. Yeah, so, you know, in the time that you and I are talking, our human race will gather 3 times more information than is in the whole American Library of Congress. Everyone listening to this program will collect more data today than Shakespeare did in his whole lifetime. And I think many of us have this sense of drowning in more information than what we know, than we know what to do with. So going fishing, taking a walk, turning off the lights and listening to the music, any of that, I think we instantly feel a lot better. And as you say, we wouldn't want to be doing it full time. I was just revisiting North Korea a few months ago, and I would never want to trade places with those guys who have to live stillness whether they like it or not.
I was raised on a very small farm. Where really nothing had changed since the medieval time. We had a draft horse, a plough, very simple, virtually nothing electrical on the place. And my grandfather never wore a watch. He'd just look up at the sky, and he knew approximately what the time was. The seasons dictated, planting, harvesting, and so on. And since then, I've watched the world accelerate. It's like we're sitting in a vehicle and someone's jammed their foot down on the accelerator, and everything is going faster and faster and faster. As you say, emotional, informational overload, and it reaches a point of driving you dotty.
Yeah, weapons of mass distraction, as they call it. And exactly right. I mean, we're all on this accelerating roller coaster, as you were saying, that we never necessarily asked to go on, but now we don't know how to get off. And we're living at a pace, really, I think, dictated more by machines than by humans. So probably in the place where you grew up, it might have seemed a little slow when you were a boy, but now even there, it's probably much too fast, all the information streaming in. So, and I think I would never want to uninvent all the wonderful machines that give us new freedoms and possibilities and that make our lives happier and healthier. But those machines never teach us how to step away from the machines. And for that, I think it's up to us, because as fast as the world is accelerating now, it's only going to accelerate more in the next 20 years. And unless we take conscious measures, we'll be dizzy. We'll be like little kids, you know, spinning in place and then falling on the ground.
I must ask you to tell the story a bit about you and Leonard Cohen, because it features in the first pages of the book.
Yes, so 20 years ago, I drove up into the high, cold, dark mountains behind Los Angeles, and just below the snow level, I came to a monastery where Leonard Cohen was living as a full-time Zen monk for 5.5 years. What struck me was that here was a man, he'd been an international heartthrob for 30 years, a recording star. He had tasted really all the pleasures life has to offer, especially in terms of sex and drugs and rock and roll. And he sat down with me night after night, and he said the greatest pleasure he had found, he was then 61 years old, was sitting still. And he said, in his characteristic way, this is the voluptuous, sumptuous excitement in life. You know, it's fun to be dizzily in love and it's fun to race around the world. But if you really want lasting exhilaration, he said, this is where it's at. This is where you investigate worlds you couldn't have imagined. And he wasn't just saying that for the moment. As I say, he spent 5 years in that monastery. And I think the second part of this is that, as you know, and as everybody in Australia knows, in the last 5 years, in his 70s, Leonard Cohen has suddenly become one of the most fashionable and popular musicians on earth. And I think that's partly because when people go and see him in concert, they're sensing wisdom and a depth and an intimacy that come from that stillness. In other words, if he'd just been leading the rock and roll life, I don't think we'd be getting songs of substance and performances of such power. So it's an interesting thing. He stepped away from the world for many years, plunged into the depths, and then came back and brought some of those depths to the rest of us.
PK, given that you made this visit 20 years ago to a Zen monastery in Los Angeles, of all places. Did that in any sense influence your decision to decamp to Japan?
I think it confirmed a suspicion I already had. So in my 20s, I was really leading the high life. I was probably having the life I might have dreamed of as a little boy. I had a 25th floor office in Midtown Manhattan. I had a really exciting job writing on world affairs for Time magazine. No responsibilities. I could take my holidays everywhere. I had an apartment on Park Avenue.
Sex, drugs, and rock and roll as well? You may confess.
Vicariously, I'd listen to Leonard Cohen and imagine I was enjoying his kind of life, but probably as close to that as I could have gotten. And I really enjoyed every moment of it. But at some point, I thought, well, I'm only seeing a small section of the world. If suddenly I was to lose my mother in a car crash tomorrow, would any of these adventures help me? I thought probably not. And I thought I ought to see something else of the world. And I think it's always a good idea to make those decisions when you're having a good time rather than when you're having a bad time. Because if you're despairing, it's hard to make a good choice. But I thought, well, I've enjoyed this to the full for 4 years. Let me move to a one-room apartment or one-room single room with no toilet or telephone or anything on the back streets of Japan, and that will give me a whole different perspective.
Mind you, you chose your city well, because Kyoto is almost agonizingly beautiful.
It is, and of course it's a place where people have been sitting still for 800 years or more. So yes, and of course it was exotic and glamorous to me, and I fell in love with my wife the third week I arrived for this monastic stint. So you're right, Japan had a lot of advantages, but I think my intuition was right that seeing life in a very quiet position in Japan would complement and really extend the little that I'd seen in the middle of New York City. And I think, you know, all the people listening to your program probably try to have that same balance in their own lives. If they're working in the middle of Sydney, I'm sure they try to get out into the silence and quiet as much as possible, because otherwise you just lose balance.
You've got a nice line, well, many a nice line, but one that I particularly enjoyed was how making a living and making a life sometimes point in opposite directions. And that's perfectly true, isn't it?
Yes, and I think when I left New York City at 29, a part of me felt, as Thoreau famously said, I didn't want to die feeling I'd never lived. And although racing around and having a good time was a certain kind of life, I felt I was racing around so much I couldn't tell how deeply happy or content I was, and I just needed to step away from that. And I think most people have had some version of that experience. And in terms of the modern acceleration that we are subject to, the other thing that's made a big impression on me is that my mother lives in California, so I spend time there. And it's actually the people in Silicon Valley who are most at the forefront of these cutting-edge technologies who are the ones who are most intent on stepping away from them. A lot of people, for example, who work at Apple and Google observe an internet Sabbath, as they call it. They go totally offline every week from Friday night to Monday morning to ensure they'll have something useful to offer when they go online again. Or they famously have meditation rooms in Apple and Google, and although I'm not a meditator myself, I think, well, that's an interesting resource for a fast-moving company to have.
Now, so, you and I are having this conversation at a time when, I think it's true, the World Health Organization is signaling that stress, the anxieties produced by stress, are going to become one of the world's leading health issues.
Exactly. I think that's why I think a third of the companies in the U.S. now have incorporated stress reduction programs offered to all their employees. And as we were saying at the outset...
Okay, slow down, be still. What is a stress reduction program and how can we have one here at our little wireless program?
Well, I believe it's often it's got to do with yoga. Sometimes it's meditation. Sometimes it's just sitting still. Sometimes it's nap rooms or places where you can be quiet. And if you're in an open plan office, just go there and close your eyes or collect your breath. Sometimes they actually have people instructing them in this. And I think, as I see it, it's really like a mental health club. You know, a few years ago, my doctor said to me, you ought to go to the health club every day because your body is crying out for it. And, of course, I did that. But sometimes people say to me, well, you ought to sit still because your mind and your heart is crying out for it. And I say, no, I don't have time for that. But actually, the mental health club is probably more important than the physical. And I think that's what the corporations are acting upon.
I don't want to throw a spanner in all of this, but I'm suddenly reminded of Arthur Koestler. And as you recall, Arthur was a very famous and energetic writer of the left, Darkness at Noon, etc. And when he fell out of love with communism, he started looking for alternatives, including Zen Buddhism and Hinduism. But I remember his sense of shock and disappointment when he discovered, and he insisted that this was scientifically validated, that people who seemed externally to be absolutely and utterly tranquil still had seething mental states. They were still thinking like crazy. That, and in fact, it didn't really work.
Well, I think that's very well said. I've spent a lot of time around a Catholic monastery in Big Sur, and I think all those monks would say, just as you did, it's not peace and quiet when they're sitting in their self. Half the time it's darkness and it's doubt and it's frustration, and it's not as if they've put away frustration and impatience just by stepping into the monastery. In some ways it intensifies it. I think anyone who's been alone in a room in the dark for an hour knows that there are peaceful moments and there are also agonizing, stormy moments, just as you were saying. But at the same time, you know, since Koestler's day, they now are able to perform actual scientific tests on people to find out how calm and how kind they are. And it's an interesting thing that when they put monks through those tests, those 3.5-hour mental scans, and when they put the rest of us through, although monks do have their moments of dark nights of the soul, they score literally off the charts in terms of peace and mind and in terms of compassion compared with you and me. So there's some good that comes out of it. I think it's just like an athlete. You know, if you practice running 6 hours a day, you'll be a much better runner than I am, and the same if you practice sitting still.
Okay, let's go back to a point I made in introducing you. What if you have no choice but to live in stillness? You're in a prison cell, as Koestler was, incidentally, for quite some time. Or you have no chance but to stay where you are. And I'm thinking of the millions that live in poverty who cannot travel. What do you say about them?
Well, I think what I'm describing is a universal human condition to some extent. In other words, it's nothing to do with a religion or certain circumstance. It's just got to do with the human's need for calm, though that's especially accentuated in us for us in the revved-up world. But somebody in prison, it's interesting, they teach meditation a lot to people in prison, partly because, as you say, they are stuck in these conditions. How are they going to make the most of them? How are they going to turn it into an advantage rather than just an affliction? Now, I was in Bombay yesterday, and if you go to the slums of Bombay, you're absolutely right. It'd be silly to tell those people you should just, you know, sit and chill out for 30 minutes a day. They have more urgent things to take care of in terms of getting enough food and shelter and medicine. But that said, once the basic needs of life are taken care of, I think this is a fundamental need, because if we're racing around, we all know this, we can't pay attention to our loved ones. We can't look after our kids. We, you know, we end up getting addictions of all kinds and mental problems. So at some level, this applies to everyone. It's not just a luxury, I would say, for people like Leonard Cohen, who've already made it in the world. I'd say it's a necessity like breathing.
You often quote in this charming little book, Emily Dickinson. Tell us about that.
Yes, well, she barely left her room for 26 years, and she was just sitting in a tiny room in the small town of Amherst, Massachusetts, really confiding her intense thoughts to the page. And I think she speaks for everything you and I have been talking about. Some of the time, she was surrounded by death, by ghosts. She was in absolute darkness. Other times, this extraordinary light came, and she had visions that most people would envy. But I think I use her as an example of somebody who, without any religious connection, spent a lot of time exploring within and exploring the dark and the silence, and came to be on intimate terms with light and death and maybe God and perhaps the devil too. But for the benefit of all of us, transcribe those feelings. And it's like going to an intense other planet when you visit her. And of course, all writers spend a lot of their time sitting still, but in her case, it was especially pronounced because she never married and she never left the room. So it's not a fail-safe recipe for happiness by any means, but for those of us who move too much, I think stopping moving is a very good idea.
Now, I moved, Koestler. You counter with your discussion of someone you describe as the happiest man on earth, the father of one of France's leading intellectuals. Tell us about Monsieur Ricard.
Yes, in fact, the son of one of France's leading intellectuals. And his story is actually quite similar to Leonard Cohen's, in the sense that he grew up in the heart of intellectual Paris. As you say, his father was the editor of the leading magazine in France. His mother was an abstract artist, so Stravinsky and Cartier-Bresson and Jean-Paul Sartre, anyone you could think of was sitting around his dinner table. And he got a PhD in biology under a Nobel Prize winner. And then in his mid-20s, he took a trip to Nepal, and he met various Tibetan teachers. And he felt that they were sitting on certain kinds of knowledge that he wasn't finding so much in Paris, and they seemed very settled and calm and in some cases wise. So he threw over this amazing career and became a full-time Tibetan Buddhist monk, which he's been for the last 40 years. And interestingly, when scientists at the University of Wisconsin decided they had the facilities at last to check people's peace of mind and to come up with actual ratings and put them into a machine for 3.5 hours to see how calm they were, he was the first person they checked because he was both a scientist and a monk.
And they attached, I understand, 256 electrodes to his skull.
Yes, and then they
even
put him
that
into
would
the
cause
machine.
Immense stress.
Yeah, exactly. And you see him after 3.5 hours in under this machine, and there are photos of this, and he's radiating calm and joy, and they could actually measure his degree of happiness, and it was so far beyond anything seen in the neurological literature that he got dubbed, to his own embarrassment, the happiest man on earth. And then there was a very interesting book that he produced with his father called call the monk and the philosopher, because his father, as intellectual a man as you could find, traveled all the way to Nepal to ask his son, why did you throw it all over and what have you found that can compensate? And they had a very interesting, as you and I are having, that discussion, really looking at both sides of the issue.
I suddenly want to raise, we've only got moments left, but I suddenly want to raise another issue. There's one category of human being who has really got a lot of time on their hands, mightn't be technically a lot, but they've got to focus on the issue of dying. And that's a time of stillness. That's a time of enforced quietude. Does it help then, do you think?
I think it's the only thing that helps. And I think that's the core of it. I'm so glad you mentioned it, because even as a young man, but certainly later, I thought, as I sort of mentioned before, if I go to the doctor tomorrow and he comes into the room wearing a very dark expression and says you have 6 months left, which maybe almost certainly at some point will happen, what is going to help me then? Will it be the times I've gallivanted off to Easter Island and Bhutan and Ethiopia? Yeah, I'm really guessing not. I'm guessing it's a time when I've been quiet, when I've tried to think about the really urgent things in life, and when I've tried to be sort of intimate with the world rather than just drinking it down. And so I think stillness, the reason all the philosophers from every tradition have practiced it, is that it's a preparation for death or just for calamity when you lose a loved one, when a car crashes into yours. What are you going to turn to and what resources do you have? And at that point, your resume, your CV, your bank account, I think, aren't going to help you. But what may help you is any resources you've built up inside yourself.
We're discussing this verbally. One of the things your book does is portray it visually. It is absolutely full of lyrical landscape and skyscape photographs.
Yes, and I have, this is one of the first books put out by TED, the people who organize the TED Talks, and I have them to thank for that because they found this wonderful Icelandic photographer. And as you say, however good or bad the text is, the book feels beautiful thanks to her photographs that are meant to carry the reader into a place of absolute clarity and peace. So the words are probably the least important part of the book, and it's really the atmosphere of the book and the fact you can hold it in your hand and that you can read it in one sitting and that you can bask in those glorious, spacious photographs.
I don't know. My response, I think, is that I don't think I want to even turn the pages. I just want to sit back and I'll look at the book. I think I'll look at it rather than have the exhaustion of physically opening it. Only joking, only joking.
No, because I know you've read it from your questions, but if somebody just looks at it, that's fine. If they enjoy the pictures, that would have just as good an effect as my words, really.
Let me now quote a great philosopher to you, and I refer, of course, to Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz. If I ever go looking for my heart's desire again, I won't look any further than my own backyard. Because if it isn't there, I never really lost it to begin with. That resonates with you, doesn't it?
Yes, and well, I think most of the great writers and philosophers have said that. I think Ralph Waldo Emerson, who's one of my favorites, said, travel is a fool's paradise. If you think you're going to find anything in Tibet or Jerusalem or Venice that you can't find at home. And I think the more you travel, and I've been lucky enough to travel a lot, the more you see that. I've had wonderful adventures and things I would never want to exchange while traveling. But really, the fundamental things I could have found without leaving my mother's house.
Okay, thank you very much, Pico. Pico Iyer, long-time travel writer, author of The Art of Stillness, Adventures in Going Nowhere, published by Simon & Schuster for TED Books. And you can listen online to Pico's TED lecture on the topic. We'll put a link on our website. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to talk about the machines that run the world, or more correctly, the formulae that run the machines, those bloody algorithms. The news is next on RN, and I'll talk to you again in, well, more or less 23 hours.